When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
I think there's a huge hunger to have an honest conversation about these issues. And folks like you allowing me to come on your show and talk about it are just invaluable for having that conversation.
Let's go.
Welcome to Citizen. We have a special guest today, Jeremy Carl. You are the author of a book called The Unprotected Class: How Anti-White Racism is Tearing America Apart. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sure, yeah. So before we get into the book and everything, let's talk about you a little bit. You said you're in Montana. Did you grow up there, or are you a transplant?
I am one of the horrible transplants who has ruined Montana. I grew up in North Carolina. I went to college up at Yale in Connecticut and then basically hightailed it out of the East Coast and have lived in various places, either a little bit abroad, but mostly in the Western United States ever since. I was a research fellow for the Hoover Institution at Stanford University for a number of years, which was a great job, but I had five kids, didn't want to raise them in California for lots of reasons, and just decided Montana would be a better place for our family. So we moved up there several years back and enjoy it.
What kind of reasons?
Well, it's so crowded. I mean, where we were was kind of the worst in some ways, although in other ways it was the best. It had a lot of opportunities, but I was in the heart of Silicon Valley. I think just the pressure that's put on kids was probably the primary one. The cost was secondary. I mean, we were doing fine. We had our own nice house. Everything kind of worked out there. But certainly looking for a future for my kids, the economics of them, you know, being able to not kind of sell their souls to big tech and yet be able to afford a house were not like super high. And I just, you know, the politics of California was definitely not copacetic with my politics. There were elements of the culture that I got along with well, but there were also just elements of the way people were really just exclusively professionally driven and things like that that were not appealing to me. So, you know, it was more than that, but that's kind of the highlights.
I noticed you didn't mention human beings shitting in the street.
Well, that's in the city. I was in Palo Alto. It was a little different, but yeah, certainly the city itself is kind of a disaster in its own way.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I lived in Oakland for a while. Are we going to switch cameras on this, or what are we doing? You're just going to record everything?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I lived in Oakland for a good while. And even there, I mean, that city's always had its problems since the fucking, let's say, 1950s, late 1950s, probably. They go back and forth, I suppose. I mean, I lived in Piedmont, which, if you know the area, is not really
I do know
Oakland.
It. Yeah.
It's kind of up on a hill overlooking Oakland. You're like, oh, look, stuff's on fire down there.
Yeah.
But I worked in San Francisco.
Right there.
What's that?
I said my aunt and uncle live right near there.
Oh, yeah. It's nice up there. And there's a good portion of Oakland is actually pretty nice. Lake Merritt is really nice. I mean, there's a lot of nice stuff around there. Just weird, man, how I don't know how to explain it. Maybe it's just a function of opportunity, but it seems like the great cities throughout human history have had this same issue where, you know, shiftless layabouts show up there and try to leech off of society. I mean, Rome was no different, right?
Right.
The reason that Rome eventually banned slavery in the city wasn't out of any ethical or moral concerns, because they took all the jobs from the free people, right? So it's like this is relatively common, I guess, throughout human history. It's just bizarre to me the way we as a society, and when I say that, I mean Western civilization. It's like we're constantly walking around congratulating ourselves, but also holding a gun to our own heads, and it just doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, absolutely. And you see this in the, I mean, cities are huge fertility sinks, and they have been throughout history, which is to say, like, people go to cities and they don't have kids. And that was another reason, you know, we got out of the Bay Area, right? Like, we were like circus freaks there with five kids. You know, my wife's like, we're normal people. My wife's an emergency physician. She's a professional. But, you know, if we had a decent sized family, that was seen as just really, really weird and odd. Whereas in Montana, it's a little more accepted.
Yeah. So what's your, what is your, you're a senior fellow at Claremont still, former research fellow at Hoover Institute at Stanford. What is your primary area of expertise, I guess, educationally? And then how has that evolved since you've been a professional? Because that's how things work, right? I mean,
yeah. Well, it's sort of funny because, a lot of what I do, the vast majority of what I do now is nothing to do with my professional training at all. Although when I was in the Trump administration, I was Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Interior, and I oversaw the Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Park Service. That was actually very much in my area. So my training was primarily in environment and resource policy, and that's what I did for a number of years. Is what I did primarily at Hoover, although not exclusively. But for really decades, I mean, I've even starting as an undergraduate, I'd been very involved in politics generally and a whole set of political issues having nothing to do with that. And I just found, and maybe it was just being in the hothouse of the Bay Area that kind of reinforced that, because people talk a lot about, you know, California being X years into the America's future. But I just increasingly was concerned with issues of immigration, cultural change, national identity, things like that. And so I was writing about those frequently over time. And I was really fortunate that when I left Hoover, the Claremont folks were very happy to have me write about those. And so I spend most of my time writing about them, although they only have a sort of tenuous connection to my formal training. Although I do in my book have an entire chapter on kind of how race plays out in the environmental movement. And actually, if you know the history of the environmental movement, both historically and contemporaneously, there's actually a lot of interesting stories there.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and that's true for a lot of stuff. The gun rights movement is also kind of an anti-racist movement, frankly. There was no real concern about machine guns or any of that stuff or but before the I guess you could say the modern mobster of the day, right? The early 20th century mobster, which was characterized by what would you say, Italian immigrants in Murder Inc., the Northeast Jewish folk, right? That was primarily who was doing a lot of the stuff there that like led to the FBI, and then later on, though, more specifically in the 60s and 70s. With all the hubbub over handguns, it was primarily about keeping handguns out of the hands of black people, particularly the Black Panther Party, right? It's interesting to me how a lot of these, it's almost like a la carte outrage, where you just bundle a couple of things that piss people off into one thing, try to sell the fact that they're related somehow, and just have, I want to run this by you because you've worked in this industry for a while, and now you're writing about it to a larger degree, but we've reached the point in Western society where everything is politicized. I think everybody knows that, but the way that it's being done is very interesting to me. Packaging disparate, unrelated things together, right? Are one way that it's done. But also anything that matters to anyone, anywhere, the media and the aristocracy weaponize and amplify the thing and essentially turn it into some kind of religion, right? I mean, that's what we're seeing now. It's like, environmentalism is a good one because the data the data is not clear about these worst case scenarios. Like the only thing you're going to hear from the legacy media is the worst case scenario, right? Which is a worst case scenario is always a possibility, but it is a fractional possibility, less than 1% chance that that's going to happen, that by 2050, right, we're going to be fucked or whatever. We very rarely talk, and Alex Epstein talks about this all the time. We very rarely talk about the more likely scenarios, which is that, every 10,000 years or so, climate changes a little bit, right?
Yeah.
It's just kind of how it works because of the wobble of the Earth. It's like very basic, basic planetary science. The wobble of the Earth means that the equator is going to be closer or farther away from the sun, essentially, right? So, it really is that simple. And it happens over the course of 10 to 20,000 years. That's why we had a massive ice age up until about 12,000 years ago. And now we're on our way probably back to another one in the next 10,000 years. But none of that seems to matter. It's all about, well, you're going to die or your kids are going to die if you don't do this thing. I feel like we were relatively post-racism for most of the country. And it was like, oh, no, look, here we found 12 examples. Out of the 273 million interactions that police have with people every year, we found that 9 unarmed black dudes are killed. So obviously racism's still there and the police are like, come on, man, what the fuck?
Right.
Like, why is it so easy for people to believe this stuff? I don't understand that. Like you've been in higher ed on both sides. Why is it so easy to dupe smart people?
Yeah, well, there's so much in the kind of statements you just made. So let me kind of decompose a few different things that you said that I thought were interesting. One, to go back to the civil rights movement and the importance of the Second Amendment there. There's actually a couple of subversive books that were sort of buried, but came out maybe a decade ago. I can't remember what one of them is titled, but the other one is titled "That Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed." And it's basically all about the important role that armed self-defense had in the civil rights movement that has kind of been shoved under the table by the left. So a little bit orthogonal to some of the discussion, but I do think it's interesting to note how that works. But I think kind of to your more broad question, you hit on this notion of religion, and I think that that's really important. And I see that a lot because I am a Christian who grew up in a secular environment. And, there's a conservative blogger named Ace of Spades. And I borrowed a quote he wrote once for an article because I thought it was really brilliant. He said, look, unlike a lot of people on the right, I'm a secularist. But I see the left are secularists, too. But they're extremely poor secularists because they think they've banished religion from their lives. And what they've actually done is let religious thinking infect every single mode of their thought. And I thought that was a very powerful concept. So I think a lot of these things, whether it be the bigger extremes of environmentalism or a lot of this anti-racism, critical race theory, anti-white racism, they're a substitute for people who have removed God from the equation. And they're looking for some other way to organize their universe. And so I think that is, I mean, again, this is a common Christian critique over many decades, but I think a lot of people are still not familiar with it, that you can't banish religious thinking from the human species. It's only a question of under what guise does it happen? And then finally, to kind of pick up on your academic question, I mean, there's actually a lot of research that shows that essentially smarter people are easier to manipulate intellectually in certain ways. And that they kind of overvalue and overestimate their own intelligence. And I would at least, I mean, I spent like 20 years in the Ivy League and adjacent. And I would say that like independence of thought and ability to self-criticize is it's orthogonal to your intelligence. So I wouldn't say that it's necessarily opposed, but it bears almost no resemblance to whether or not you're smart. Hmm. That's just kind of my take.
Well, it seems like, if I remember correctly, when I was described brilliant people as a child, like learning about the history of thought, history, science, mathematics, physics, so on, that, you know, skepticism played a pretty large role in that, if not the biggest role, right?
Sure.
The way that I was taught to write long research papers, even into grad school at Penn State, when you write a research paper, you address the criticisms of your premise somewhere towards the end, right? And if yeah. you like, that's a big part of the peer review process as well. Like if you right. don't thoughtfully address the critiques of your premise, typically speaking, you're going to get rejected during the peer review process, or it's going to get flagged. Right now, it's like. Yeah. But now it's even worse. After COVID, we have something called preprint, which I'm sure you're familiar with, which is like, somebody thought it, wrote it down. So yeah, now it's part of the goddamn epistemology all of a sudden with no right. like, oh, my God. Anyways, what would it look like, I guess, if. Because it does seem like. All of this stuff has supplanted religion to some degree, right? Which is pretty interesting. It's like. It's like we stop eating. This is the, I guess, the educational version of eating processed food, right? Because we're still eating technically, right? We're just doing it like idiots now. So what would it look like if this, whatever this modern religion, actually, if skepticism was a primary tenet of it, right? I think that might be a little bit more useful.
Yeah, oh, for sure. And I mean, I write up at front in my book, kind of take on the skeptical case immediately. And I try to also, you know, to acknowledge where the skeptical case has points. And I do that even before I get into making my own case, because I think it's important to do. You know, they call that steel manning as opposed to straw manning, right? You kind of give your opponent's best possible case against you. And I think that's really important to do if you're going to write an intellectually honest book. And even in doing this, the best thing I think my editors did is it wasn't a book with a lot of overheated rhetoric even to begin with. But as we went through the editorial process, if anything looked overheated, we just took it out. You know, we let the facts speak for themselves. I think, you know, unfortunately, I think this is a problem with the human species. And I know this because... my father, he's an academic research scientist. I mean, he's retired, but he was an academic physicist, and he's a rationalist par excellence. And I think, you know, he's always puzzled that and frustrated that the human species is not always rational and skeptical. And I would just sort of say, you know, I share your frustration, but it's just not how people are wired for the most part. You know, you get religious thinking, and I think religious thinking in the context of actual religion to me is a very wonderful thing. But when it begins to affect things that shouldn't be religious, then it becomes a real problem.
And, in that vein, you've kind of, I'm curious about your thoughts, 'cause you've been in academia during a time of great transition, I guess. Now, it isn't. That's not to say that Marxism wasn't in American universities in the early part of the 20th century, and that's definitely when the infiltration began. But doing so openly and brazenly is a modern thing, right? I mean, they're not trying to really hide that anymore. Makes sense that they would go after young minds, obviously, right? I mean, there's a reason Joe Camel got banned from advertising. But. How would you characterize the difference in, let's just say, Yale University from the time you were a student there until now? Because I think things have changed pretty rapidly and markedly.
Yeah. Well, and I don't want to go with rose-colored glasses. I mean, I entered Yale as a freshman in 1991, so that was quite some time ago. But we had all the roots of a lot of these problems there. I mean, the faculty was certainly in no way politically balanced, nor was the administration. But I mean, people were just more normal, right? Like, I don't know, you look like you're probably roughly of the same generation as me. Mm. I mean, like, I grew up in the 80s and maybe people talk about smartphones or whatever it is. I don't know everything it was, but we were just way more normal. And I think life was easier in some ways, not that we didn't have our own struggles or difficulties, but I think the society was overall a more functional place. So that kind of rolls into it. But at this point in 2023, 24, the inmates have just completely taken over the asylum. They had taken over a lot of the asylum even when I came. I mean, I remember hanging up in 1991 a Newsweek cover story on political correctness on my dorm room wall as a freshman. So, I mean, that's what we called wokeness today. I mean, this stuff was there even back then. But now it's just all of the institutional safeguards are gone. And so you've got these crazy protests. And again, this is not related to the substance of how one feels about Israel-Palestine, but it's just the way in which these go on and their disruption to people who want to learn. It's just a... I think the universities are basically beyond saving at this point. And of course, the Biden administration, that's what this student loan, these massive bailouts are really about. They're not really about the students. They're about bailing out the corrupt university system, which is a massive jobs program for the left. And that's really what's driving it.
It does seem like there's a pipeline. It's like social outrage to social movement to creating infrastructure for a business surrounding that social movement, let's say abortion or the NRA or any of this stuff, right? It always, like, an entire industry tends to pop up around these social or political issues. And then the issue just never goes away. Like, there's no feasible reason we should have been debating one social political issue for almost 100 years now, right? That is absolutely insane to me. But we don't seem to make any progress because it's pretty clear this people are in intractable positions on some of these issues, right? Like no amount of data or no amount of reasoning is going to change any of that stuff.
Right.
And I guess that's why, you know, federalism matters, because you can move to a new state that looks a little bit more like what you wanted to, you know. That's kind of the point of this whole system, I think.
Yeah, I mean, and if I'd love it if we had more federalism and more principle of subsidiarity and all that good stuff. I think that obviously it's very frustrating to watch these things, but I think a lot of these attempts to get us to be distracted by, I'm not trying to, I've lived abroad. I'm not trying to say that what's going on outside our borders shouldn't matter to us at all. But I do often think that the people who try to wind us up about things going on outside our borders are the people who, in my experience, really, really notably, like almost universally, people who won't defend me and people like me inside our borders. So in my book, The Unprotected Class, you know, I talk a lot about, I detail in great, great detail over 1,000 references in 12 different areas where anti-white discrimination and racism is going on very significantly. There are some people in Congress who've taken a real interest in that. Not too many, but an increasing number. And that is exactly the opposite of the people who get really wound up about what's going on in foreign affairs. And the people who get really wound up in vindicating themselves as heroes in a foreign conflict on whatever side, I find often seem to be compensating for the fact that they won't have the more difficult discussion about vindicating their own supporters' rights here in America, which is more a fractious discussion than, you know, pretending to play the hero abroad. Mm.
Yeah, I wonder if, 'cause trends do tend to repeat themselves. I wonder if there was a time in some other government prior to now where people so audibly and fervently argued against their own best interests. Some obvious examples pop into my mind, like defund the police. That's stupid, right? Like, now your communities are all fucked. Queers for Palestine is hilarious because, one, there's no such thing as Palestine in the first place. But beyond that, let's say there was. Go there and do queer stuff and see what happens. You can Google right. that, by the way. I don't know if Google will give you the actual results. You may have to go to a different browser, but you can yeah. you can search the internet and find out what happens to quote unquote queer people in so-called Palestine. Or maybe more along the lines of your expertise, Biden reversing Trump's efforts to make us more energy independent, right? Like what exactly was the point of that? Like we're right. putting, we take the worst case scenario from environmentalists who are getting paid to tell us that and say, that's reality. That's a fact. So we have to build our national policy off of that, no matter what it costs us, because it's an existential threat. We're all going to die. We have to, right? Yeah. But none of yeah. that is really true. And now we're getting to a point where we're going to, where we're still having to deal with Middle East bullshit because we need their right. oil, or Russian bullshit because we need their oil, right? It's like, right. has there ever been a time in human history where people, like an entire half of a political class in a country, are all arguing to fuck up the country they're in?
Yeah, I mean, and I've studied a lot of history, and there are some things to me about our current situation that are unique, although I think the process of degeneration and decadence is sort of a universal thing of all powerful empires. And I'd argue the U.S., whether we're not, we're formally imperial, ultimately, informally at least, behaves like an empire. You know, all the things you're saying about...
This episode is brought to you by Ghostbed. Ghostbed.com/drinkerbros. Go there today and get 50% off site wide. All their mattresses, all the sheets, everything. They've got the Ghostbed Classic. They've got the Ghostbed 3D Matrix. They've got the Ghostbed Lux. And now they've got the new one, the Ghostbed Flex Hybrid. All these are cooling mattresses. They're the best in the business. They also have the new technology that we've been looking for all this time. Well, not we, just Joel, which is the RV mattress. Now, if you've got one of these things, you know that you can't find a mattress that fits them appropriately, at least not a good one. And the ones that come with them are terrible. So if you're you know, an RV person, you definitely want to jump on that. And by the way, they got the best pillows in the business. You've heard me say it before, but I travel with these things. That's how good they are. It's kind of a pain in the ass, but not as bad as sleeping on hotel pillows, I'll tell you that much. So go to ghostbed.com/drinkerbros today. Use the code Ghost or Drinker Bros at checkout. You're going to get 50% off all the mattresses. Check them out today. We've been with them for a while. I've got them all over my house. You know they're good. So my best advice here is go for the 3D Matrix. It's the most comfortable bed I've ever slept on in my life. Go get it today. Go to ghostbed.com/drinkerbros. Use the code Drinker Bros. You're going to get 50% off. That's 50% off. You're not going to get a better deal. This episode is brought to you by firstform.com/citizen. Free shipping on all orders over $75 when you use the link. And you're not going to spend less than $75. I mean, they get the best products in the world, especially the OptiGreens. You know me, I don't eat vegetables because they're fucking pointless. So I supplement with OptiGreens 50 from First Form. It is precisely formulated green superfood powder meant for overall immune system support and digestive health. It's really good, aside from just getting the daily greens into your body that you need. And make sure, by the way, you're taking this with MCT, because you have to take anything like this with MCT. 80% of your immune system is located in your gut and your digestive tract, right? So healthy digestion is essential for overall health and wellness, not to mention that most of your serotonin, I think 96% of your serotonin or 94%, is made in your gut as well. So you're going to be in a better mood. You're going to feel better physically, and you're going to feel better mentally if you are taking these greens. OptiGreen 50 has 50 chosen ingredients, effectively dosed. It's not necessarily how many ingredients there are, though, but it's about the right amount of each. Taste and texture, not like no other product in the market. It's not gritty. It doesn't have a weird flavor. It's got sweet berry flavors, actually. 100% of the greens are all grown and manufactured inside the United States, and they are bioavailable. Now, they've got other products as well. They've got the Microfactor, which you see behind me on every show, and I take them every day. You know, you got essential fatty acids, CoQ10, you get all the stuff you need in one little packet for your daily vitamin pack. And you mix that, you make yourself OptiGreens 50 shake, and you take those pills with it, and you're going to improve your life precipitously. You're going to feel better, you're going to look better, so on and so forth. So go to firstform.com, that's firstform.com/citizen. Use the code, you're going to get free shipping on all orders over $50. This episode is also brought to you by BlackRifleCoffee.com. Calm, the best coffee in the world. As a matter of fact, they won both the gold and bronze medal at the Golden Bean Awards this year for their exclusive coffee club entries in the elite category. So the best coffee on earth literally was Circus Bear by Black Rifle, one of their ECS. So I recommend that you go sign up for the Black Rifle Coffee Club. Use the code CITIZEN. You're going to get those points off. And, you know, you get all the benefits for being in the coffee club. You get the free shipping. You get access to all the partner deals. You get access to the exclusive coffee club. You get access to any new products that come out before anybody else does. You know, it's a very large club that they have over there. And the coffees are premium. Every single one of them is good. You're going to get experience for you. You can do just the plain coffee club. And if you want your two bags of espresso or your two bags of silencer smooth or whatever it is you drink, you can get those two bags or one bag or whatever you want every month, or rather you can use the ECS, the exclusive coffee club, and get access to some of the most premium coffees on the planet and kind of learn what it is that you like. You know what I mean? So then you can order those premium coffees from Black Rifle as well. So, and we all know they got the best branding, the best merch, and they're buddies. You know, we're all friends here. We love Black Rifle. So go to blackriflecoffee.com, sign up for the coffee club, or buy something. Do whatever you want. Use the code CITIZEN. You're going to get those points off.
The environment, et cetera, are well taken, and how we've kind of sabotaged ourselves on energy independence, and we kind of only pay attention to these most extreme voices. And again, I think these are very religious problems. Again, to get to, I think, an interesting kind of question that you sort of raised about self-sabotage and self-hatred. One really interesting thing that I show in the book, and actually I think will be a lot more of the sequel of this book, is that basically, if you look at the social science literature where they survey people about whether they have, like, what degree do they prefer their own group? So you look at, you survey African Americans, Hispanics, Asian Americans, white Americans, and unsurprisingly, everybody has an in-group preference. You know, they like their own group more than other groups. There's nothing even unhealthy about that, as long as it doesn't go too extreme, just like, you know, you like your mother more than somebody else, some random woman on the street. And you see a little bit more of an in-group preference among conservatives, regardless of their ethnicity. But again, it's not... there's nothing really anomalous or nothing that really kind of strikes you when you look at the data, except for liberal whites. And liberal whites have a very significant outgroup preference. And I'm not aware of this for any other nation in the social science literature. So liberal whites think white people are more criminal, you know, they're dumber, they're like pretty much go down the line. This is, I mean, you don't find that among liberal minorities. It is extraordinarily anomalous. And I think a lot of this kind of deep psychological deformation, for lack of a better term, explains something of why we are in the place we are today on issues around race.
Why? How do you quantify the prominence of anti-white racism? Like how? Because it's easy to just sample on what's available, right? But that's not necessarily right. Like it's garbage in, garbage out, right? Technically speaking.
Sure.
So how do you quantify that?
Right. Well, I mean, I think there's two different types, right? There's and some of it is actually, I mean, I kind of wrestled with whether I was going to use the word racism versus discrimination in the title, and I ultimately chose racism because there are elements that are discriminatory even if they maybe don't have a purely racist intent. And then there are elements where I think they're clearly racist, but it's more sort of informal. So there's not formal discrimination that you can point to that's looking at it. I certainly think in everything that happened in the summer of 2020, you talked about these, you know, 9 unarmed black men getting shot. And so we're going to burn down every city and call every policeman racist. I mean, that's a pretty large quantity of social disturbance that's going on. I think when you look at affirmative action in universities, you're talking about a significant number of seats that are being taken away from more qualified white and also Asian American students in general that are going to lesser qualified other than their skin tone African American and Hispanic students. I documented something that Tucker Carlson picked up when he was on Fox, just to give you kind of a, you know, so Joe Biden of the 97 federal judges he picked in his first 2 years, 22 of them were African-American women. And if you were to look kind of on any objective measure of legal accomplishments as sort of senior partnerships at big law firms, publication record, all these, you know, anything you could do to kind of make that an objective criterion, you know, that number rather than 22 might have been one. And you had five white men, despite the fact that white men would have been at the other end of that spectrum. And of course, federal judges are, as we know, really, really powerful positions. So I'd say that really the effect is it's quite significant and it's getting larger. And while I do certainly have anecdotes in my book, I'm not just trying to cherry pick. I think it's a pretty consistent story that you can tell throughout a number of different areas of society.
Well, first, Asian people are white now. I don't know if you heard that.
Yeah.
Because this is how you keep the industry going.
Right.
You know, gay people got all the stuff they wanted and, you know, good for them. But it, for some reason, didn't stop there. Weird. You know, now there's dudes dressed up like women reading children's stories to children in their costumes. Yeah. That's bizarre, right? Not to say that, you know, we should stop somebody from pursuing civil liberties because somebody might abuse it, but we should definitely be aware. And I think the people pursuing rights should be the most aware of what the dangers of what they're asking for is, right?
Yeah.
You know, like when you, if you knock on my door, And I'm like, who is it? Oh, it's Jeremy. All right, come in, man. And you let in like two wolves behind you. That's kind of on you, right?
Yeah.
That's your fault. Maybe you should have policed your own people. And it seems like now the word white or whiteness just means in when they're trying to use it in a way that's negative, it's oppressor, colonizer, whatever. When they try to use it in a way that's positive, it just means successful. That's all.
Yeah.
That's all that word means in that context. It's like, oh, well, right. Jewish people are technically white. Like, I mean, yeah, a lot of them are white Europeans, I guess.
Right.
Right. But no Asian people are Caucasian that I'm aware of. So I'm not sure. Like, if the population is dumb enough to believe that, why not say it?
Well, yeah, that's, you just explained a lot of our politics beyond just this issue, right? But, I do actually talk quite a bit in the book about Asian erasure, because so much of this narrative around white privilege depends on, you know, don't look at the Asian American behind the curtain, because that Asian American on average has a higher income, has a higher education, has better health outcomes. And this is despite the fact, of course, that many of these folks, either they or their parents, arrived here perhaps with little or no education, no money, didn't speak the language that well. I mean, again, I'm not saying universally, obviously, it's heterogeneous, depending on which Asian American person or population. But if we mention that, if we call attention to that fact, the white privilege narrative kind of collapses. So we either have to just ignore it and not talk about it at all, or kind of lump them in with white people. And I remember there was, when I was in Silicon Valley, there was an amazing article in the San Jose Mercury News. It was a cover story. I wish I'd saved it. But it was basically all about how white people were sort of overrepresented in the leadership of Silicon Valley. But it was actually ignoring the fact that Asian Americans were really the ones who were dramatically, dramatically overrepresented in the leadership of Silicon Valley. But to tell the story they wanted to tell about white privilege, they just simply, they ignored the numbers, or they just kind of disregarded Asians and were just looking at like the black-white ratio. That was the only thing that mattered. And it really was just a remarkable indication to me of how the regime media, the legacy media, just lets narrative completely drive the story over facts.
Yeah. People ask me this a lot. It's like, why does it seem like leftists hate white people? I'm like, I don't think that's the right question. I think the question is, why do people not notice that this is just repackaged Marxism, right? They just they're mad libbing the oppressor oppressed roles.
Yeah.
They just switch those out and then change some of the dialogue to make it contextualized. But it's just the same tired old bullshit that has led to nothing but famine. I mean, I don't know if there's any natural disease that has caused more famine than Marxist stupidity, frankly. It's like between Stalin and Mao alone, 100 million people are just wiped off the face of the earth because of their political beliefs. That's insane.
Yeah, it's nuts. And you're right that this does absolutely fold into the sort of Marxist oppression, or rather oppressor oppressed kind of dichotomy. And you just are switching out the groups. I'm not a person who's like quite as much of a purist on that as some people. I mean, a guy like James Lindsay, who I actually like, and I think he does some interesting work, you know, he'll try to shoehorn everything into that. I do think that a lot of what you see, and this becomes very important, is I do think it's amenable to an economic analysis, in that I argue in the book, in the penultimate chapter, that kind of fundamentally what drives all of this is competition for resources, which is the same thing that drives the vast majority of social conflicts. White people are perceived to, as a totality, have a lot of resources. Other groups would like those resources. In 2024, you don't simply, it's not acceptable to kind of go up to people and just say, you know, hey, I want your stuff. So you come up with what the late sociologist C. Wright Mills would call a legitimating ideology. So you come up with an ideology that says, I'm justified in taking your stuff. And that is because you're a racist, because you're a white supremacist, because the history of America is evil, because you have white privilege, et cetera, et cetera. And so you use all of this stuff. Everything I'm kind of documenting in the book is all about the creation of this legitimating ideology that can kind of come in and justify resource transfer from one group to another.
Do you think that, and this is kind of an off-the-wall question, but do you think that a root cause of all this is to some degree multiculturalism? Because you don't see it in Northern European countries that are still more or less, homogenous, right? I mean, it's, and I don't mean racially homogenous, I mean culturally. Like, let's just get right into it. It's a common saying on the left that multiculturalism is our greatest strength. I don't see how that could possibly be. Like, how could intrinsic division be a strong point for us? That doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned this, because this is something I take on very frontally in the book. The origin of the phrase, as best people can tell, diversity is our strength, ironically comes from Dan Quayle, not considered the brightest light in American political history, George H.W. Bush's vice president, was something he said in the wake of the LA riots, which were the sort of horrible civil disturbance in the early 1990s, to a bunch of Japanese businessmen, sort of saying, but I agree with you. I mean, I think that all things being equal, diversity is a weakness. Now, I want to be very careful when I say that, so that it's not misinterpreted. I'm not saying that people who make up diverse groups of people are bad people. I'm saying this kind of gets to what you were really saying. At the very kind of heart of the idea of being multicultural or diverse means you're less unified. Now, obviously, you can go too far in the other direction and you're just some uniform fascist or communist state. You're totalitarian. You don't have any freedom. You don't have any expression. So I'm not suggesting that that's the ideal, but I'm suggesting that it's, in fact, in general, very good to be much more unified around your a culture and ethnicity, everything else. And you can have a certain amount of diversity within that, but it's really good if people understand this is who we are. You know, and there's a unity about that. We have, the left has just memed the opposite thing into reality, but it can't disguise the actual results of what it's doing. And those results are not very good at all.
Yeah. I mean, like if you're in a, if I'm running a study or I'm trying to solve a problem, or even if I'm putting together a military unit or a sports team, definitely there are forms of diversity that are a net positive for everyone, right? Like biodiversity is really good because it makes us more resilient. The idea that we have like racial purity, or I guess the way that the aristocracy would have put it back in the day as being born in the purple, like having good blood, so-called good blood, which led to the end of the German Empire, right? Because they all came out retarded eventually, right? The Habsburgs, they all came out like, I think there's one dude left and he's got flippers or something. I don't know what happened with those people. But yeah, that's obviously not good. So so there are cases where diversity makes sense, biodiversity, diversity of thought, certainly, right? Like if I'm in a room trying to game plan, I want to hear every piece of information I can, and I don't want to get pigeonholed or stovepiped by just an echo chamber, right? Like I want to have a real diversity of thought. And that's what right and left are supposed to be, not just in politics, but in the home, right? Mom's empathetic, dad is stern, but he's, you know, a provider, protector, all this stuff. Like the same left-right model exists in every part of human existence. And the fact that it would map itself onto our politics makes perfect sense. It should, as a matter of fact, do that. But, man, we've taken it in some weird places. We really have. It's like we don't need – if diversity comes and the way it looks is, well, I have to accept the fact that this – entire community who has the ability to vote a person into Congress believes in Sharia law and Dearborn, Michigan. Like, no, I'm fucking done. I don't need that kind of diversity in my life. Sorry.
Right.
Explain to me exactly how that's a net positive, and because you can't, right? That's nonsense. So, I haven't heard a good response to that. I want to steel man that argument. How could cultural diversity be a good thing? Because I don't see how it possibly could.
Well, I think it's right. Past a certain point, it's not. And again, if you have a little bit, it can be okay. But when you have big communities calling for Sharia law, it's just not okay. Or, you know, maybe, I mean, it wouldn't be okay from my perspective, even in some other place. But I've traveled in places that are conservative Muslim places. And if that's what they want in their community, that's fine. I mean, I'm not going to push, you know, trannies on them. I mean, I wouldn't want it in the U.S. either, but that's a separate discussion. But yeah, I think you have to say, and for people who kind of bristle at the idea that there should be a core American identity, even if there is a certain amount of diversity both outside that and even within it, they say, oh, well, we're just a creedal nation. Well, what are the creeds that we're all supposed to believe in? And do you get ejected for not believing in them? Like, are we going to kick out those guys who believe in Sharia law because that's just not American? Are we going to say, like, regardless of where you're born, you're no longer a citizen? No, I mean, I don't think we're going to do that. And so that suggests that there are sort of limits as to who and what sorts of belief systems and people we want to be letting in the country, because we're not just a creedal nation. We're actually, at least historically, we've been a people. And I think without, again, one of the many things I talk about, if we don't get control of our border, we have no possibility of reconstituting another stable American national identity. We're just going to become a fractious group of people fighting with each other.
So I don't know how much you follow European politics. It's been getting pretty weird. Especially the border security stuff is affecting anybody that's in the EU, because the EU charter requires that every state takes on 150,000 immigrants a year, right?
Right.
Which is, that's pretty wild, to be honest. I'm not sure I would be okay with that. As a matter of fact, I'm sure I wouldn't. And then in the UK, especially with censorship and speech issues, it's become a real problem. Britain has, over the past couple of years, had some issues with people posting things online and getting accosted by police and such. But now Ireland and Scotland are up in the game big time. Ireland arresting, like, you can be arrested in Ireland if an offensive meme is found on your phone, which means if you post it on the internet and then they can get a search warrant, look on your phone. And if the meme is physically on your phone, you can be arrested for that. Scotland, I believe, passed a law a couple weeks ago or it went into effect. They may have passed it previously, that says if you misgender or dead name somebody, you can be fined $10,000. And put in prison for that. Now today, Scotland's what do you call the position? First minister, which is essentially their prime minister, is resigning. Now, oddly enough, his name is Hamza Yousaf. not Scottish, so far as I can tell, right? The mayor of London is not a name that you would expect. It's like, when should we expect, since you follow European politics and maybe an extension of that, when should we expect somebody like Dave Smith or Dave Jones or Gary to be, I don't know, the president of Somalia, right?
Yeah. Well, it'll never happen. Again, I mean, I, something I point out, I mean, I've done a lot of work on immigration policy. Not every subject that I cover in the book is something I'm an expert in. And in those I wasn't, I went and grabbed experts to review my chapter. But immigration is an area that I've worked in a lot. So it's one of the meatier chapters. China doesn't have anything like our immigration policy. They let in a few thousand people a year from mostly culturally aligned Asian countries, similar with Japan, similarly with you name your African country. It is sort of a unique idea that the West needs to be multicultural in this particular way. I think it doesn't really make a lot of sense. I've actually spent two different stints of about a month over in Hungary, which is run by Viktor Orban, who's been the one big European dissenter to this model. He's basically like, yeah, we're not doing that. We're going to keep Hungary Hungarian. I ultimately think that that model, I mean, it's being vindicated in real time. You can go out on the streets of Budapest in 2 a.m. and not worry about your safety. But I think it will be vindicated even more as time goes on. The problem is, how much of the West are we going to give up before we do anything to vindicate it?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably not great that people from other countries are organizing rallies and chanting death to America from inside their own borders. Yeah. That seems like a problem to me. That would be like, if you want to protest Walmart and you're in their parking lot, maybe you've got a cause. But if you're in aisle 18, you know what I mean? Probably going to get arrested. I don't know how you map this on to the U.S., though. I'm curious about your thoughts on that.
Well, we're different, right? I mean, we're not Europe. And so this is always a chain. I mean, you know, France, and again, you can play games with this because if you go look at genetics, you know, a lot of these countries will be pretty similar. But France has always had a French identity, or at least it has for a long time, of being for French people. The U.S. has never quite had that particularistic an identity. But we were, at least for until the 1965 Hart-Celler immigration bill, which I talk quite a lot about in the book because it's the root of why we're here as a country on immigration. We were basically a European country, at least in terms of the origins of the vast majority of our citizens, with the exception of African-American descendants of slaves. And it was really only in the post-60s timeframe that we began to get large numbers of people outside of that tradition. Now, I take that as a fait accompli. I mean, there's people on the sort of further reaches of the right who have, you know, more radical things they want to do about that. I'm just, you know, I'm not going to participate in any of that. I kind of take it as like, hey, this is what we did. This was our immigration policy. Wouldn't have been my choice necessarily, but here we are. We have to deal with it. We have to reunify a country around whatever the mix of the folks we have here now. We have to unify around that identity. But the kind of first law of holes is, if you're in one, stop digging. And the Biden administration in particular is eager to have us dig deeper and deeper, and to just kind of have the U.S. become a holding pen for anybody in the world who wants to come here. And I think it's not sustainable, obviously.
Let me clarify. Do you mean by not engaging with the, I guess, the far reaches of the right, does that mean you would be against mass deportation of all these people that have come here the last 5-7 years?
Well, for illegals, absolutely not. I mean, and you know, maybe in the modern kind of contemporary thing, that makes me some right-wing extremist. No, I mean, every illegal immigrant should be deported unapologetically. There are people on the further reaches of the right who talk about things like remigration, or, you know, convincing people who are here legally or citizens, really just on the basis, I mean, sometimes they'll say, well, it's really, you know, it's about whether they've embraced the culture, but, like, you know, to basically say that they shouldn't become citizens effectively just because they're not of European descent. Mm. So that, you know, I'm not on that train. Okay. I mean, I've got friends of all hues and backgrounds who are a lot better Americans than a lot of white Americans in every respect, including defending traditional American culture as we would perceive it. So like, I'm not signing up for that, but at the same time, yeah, I mean, absolutely close the border, deport every illegal alien. I'm signing up for that very comfortably.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I always, for years now, I've proposed it's a one for one swap. It's kind of like being an exchange student, but you're a shiftless layabout from the Pacific Northwest that's a professional protester. Guess what? You live in El Salvador now, bud.
Yeah.
And we're going to take one of those dudes and give him a job because he actually wants to fucking work. Because, you know, it's interesting what you pointed out before about the United States and how different it is. It is technically, I think, still very much like a European country. And it's not now and never has been defined by the race of the people that live there. You could make a case that Christianity, Judeo-Christianity especially, but Christianity specifically, plays a large role in our culture. But, you know, the letter, the Treaty of Tripoli kind of dispels that rumor from the very beginning, right? In 1803, I think it was.
Although that was a diplomatic document. I can't remember whether I talk about it in the book, but I've talked about it elsewhere. I mean, the kind of big things that people see is to kind of say, oh, well, the U.S. was never at all Christian from the beginning. You know, you hit on the key thing, Treaty of Tripoli. So that's in Libya. He's trying to reassure this non-Christian potentate that, yeah, we're not really Christian. But if you look at the vast majority of evidence from that time, you know, you get a very different story. Similarly, the wall of separation between church and state comes from Jefferson's letter to the Danbury Baptists. Okay, the Baptists were kind of annoyed that there was effectively a state church in Connecticut that was getting all sorts of benefits, and they weren't getting them. So Jefferson, who's on the far left on religious issues of the founders, is kind of saying, oh yeah, you know, this is all separate, but not everybody would have agreed with him. So, I mean, I wouldn't go so far as to say that the U.S. is sort of exclusively historically only been Christian, but I think that Christian identity does play a big role.
Yeah, I mean, even in the legal precursors, I would say that's probably true, right?
Right, in the founding document, or when we signed our peace treaty, the Treaty of Paris with the UK, it starts out in the name of the Holy and Undivided Trinity.
And so,
you know, again, this is one of these things where the left has seized on. I mean, we had state churches in the U.S. until 1833 in states. They've seized on the idea that, hey, it's probably not good to enforce a religious view on somebody, and I certainly subscribe to that. And we've given them that inch, and of course, then they've taken a mile in which forced transgenderized secularism is the thing that we need to obey. And similarly, they've taken the very good tendency in the U.S. to say that, hey, we have a little bit more capaciousness and expansiveness in terms of how we define American identity from a racial or ethnic perspective. They've tried to take that and erase the historical European nature of the vast majority of the American population. And so I think, you know, this is a pretty fundamental critique I have of the way the left does business.
I wonder, 1833 is an interesting year for that because it's a couple of years after the Book of Mormon was published. And I think a rising populist cult, as it was known at the time, probably would get some movement in Washington on, like, oh, we better actually make a rule on this at some point, right?
Certainly, I think it was Massachusetts was the last state to expel the – there had never been a national state church, but different states had had their own church because of who had been organized it. And certainly the Mormons are kind of an interesting case. And for those who really kind of know early Mormon history, and I'm pretty familiar with that, I mean, they move originally to Salt Lake City because it's outside of the United States. And then the San Francisco Gold Rush happens, and suddenly they find themselves back in America again and having to deal with that and all of its problems.
Oh yeah. That's a very interesting history if you're curious about it. If you're out there and you haven't read the history of Mormonism, including the death of Joseph Smith, it's a very interesting little subject. But as back to the United States, it hasn't necessarily been Like, we haven't gone out of our way to prevent non-Christians from coming here, I don't think. Right. As a matter of fact, we've been pretty brutal towards our Christian brethren, if you want to call them that. We fucked up the Irish pretty good. The largest lynching in the history of the country were a bunch of Italian dudes down in New Orleans. But there always has been this idea that hard work equals success here. If nowhere else on earth, if you work hard here, you will be a success. It's almost guaranteed, right? Absent force majeure or something like that.
Right.
That seemed to be the general criteria on who we would and would not let in for a very long time. And that is very clearly no longer the case. And I wonder from your perspective, you've worked in this, you've worked in the federal government as well. What, if you had to pinpoint one or a series of motivations for leftists on this whole subject, what could they, because there's nothing, it's not true that these people are going to be voting in the next election. That's not true.
Right.
Now you could say they're manipulating congressional districts, but that's not going to have an effect until at earliest the 2032 election, because the next census isn't until 2030, right? So, I mean, maybe they're playing that long of a game. Maybe, I guess, who fucking knows? But it seems like there's a more immediate plan going on here, and I'm not entirely sure what it is.
Well, I think there'll be some. We don't have voter ID, right? So there'll be some illegal voting. There'll be 2032 apportionment. There'll be just a broader strengthening of non-white communities in the U.S., all of which the Democrats perceive to be of interest. I do think it's interesting you touched on. I mean, we actually do have laws on the books in the U.S. that says basically if you're an immigrant and you're going to be a public charge, i.e. like a welfare recipient, you're not allowed to stay here. Immigrants are hugely disproportionately represented under welfare recipients, and we don't enforce that law. And when the Trump administration even tried to enforce it a little bit, liberal judges who simply don't care about the law at all other than their personal preferences just strike it down despite the plain text of the law being really clear as to what it's doing. But I think it's, you know, it's the Democrats want to replace the current population. I've touched on to some degree it being driven by self-hatred. I think to some degree it is also a class divider. So if you are a very, very wealthy white person, you can say, you know, I can afford some discrimination against myself. I can afford to not get these things because I'm going to be fine anyway. My kids are going to be fine anyway. But for the white middle class, the white working class, which is to say the vast majority of whites in America, that's not true. And so you're beginning to see this really sharp divide between particularly elite leftist whites and other whites. And then other whites being joined in this case by working class Hispanics down at the border and you know, other interesting groups kind of joining with them.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I wonder if the point of the anti-white stuff, aside from the broader picture, which is you just need, in Marxism, you need in and out, you need in out groups. I wonder if the specific point in the execution of anti-white racism isn't just to be, an antithesis of perceived racism on the right, which in reality is just the preservation of like culture and economy. You know what I mean? It's like, it just seems like gaslighting. It's like, oh, you guys are racist, so it's okay to be racist to you. It's like, no, I just don't want a bunch of terrorists in my goddamn country. There's like over 300 known terrorists have entered the country in the last 4 years. I don't want that. I feel like that's an okay thing to not want and doesn't reflect on how I feel about other cultures.
Yeah. No, there's a tremendous amount of gaslighting going on. There's a tremendous amount of gaslighting and a constant regime propaganda needs to take place to kind of ignore the reality in front of us. And that's really, I mean, if you want to ask me, like, why did you write the book? That's the core of why I wrote the book, because I wanted to just lay out in the unprotected class in painstaking detail how this anti-white racism, how this anti-white discrimination was taking place in any number of different fields. And to tell people who are seeing this, like, hey, you're not crazy. Don't let them gaslight you. You don't need to be treated this way. You can stand up for yourself. You don't need to get some minority person to speak on your behalf, although I'm always happy when minority folks do want to join with white folks who are concerned about this. But don't let the regime gaslight you as to what's going on in this country.
And the only way that you can really accomplish that is to educate yourself on the subject, right? I mean, you have to know all of the details. You have to know that the things that people are saying aren't true. And it takes some time and effort, I mean, honestly, to educate yourself on the issue. It also takes some time and effort and patience to try to communicate this to people. You know, obviously, not everybody's going to be standing at a lectern. Not everybody's going to be giving public speeches and shit like that. But the conversations that all of you have on a daily basis with the people around you matter. Let's say that's the algorithm that that most greatly affects our collective epistemology, is what you are willing or not willing to just accept, right? Because if you just stay quiet and accept, like, oh, cops are racist because whatever, right? No, I mean, maybe take 5 minutes and explain to somebody. Just ask them the question, how many unarmed black people do you think are killed by police every year? The the solid Democrat voter is going to say 100. The left-leaning person is going to say 100.
The left-leaning person actually says 1,000.
Yeah, the lifelong Democrat says 1,000. The progressive says 10,000. The number is 9 to 12, right?
Yeah, like just, that's right.
I think just pointing out that one piece can be very effective, you know, but you have to know it first. So one of the reasons, one of the ways that you get to know stuff like this is to read books like this. So if you had to elevator pitch me the book, what's the premise and what's the point? Right. Like, what are you trying to teach people here?
So the premise is the elephant is an elephant. And what do I mean by that? You've probably heard the story of the blind men each touching a part of the elephant and they think it's something else. OK, what I've tried to do in this is to take anti-white racism, anti-white discrimination as happening in 11 or 12 different fields, each of which has a chapter in the book, document that really, really thoroughly. And say, hey, the elephant is an elephant. This is all interconnected. There's an underlying ideology behind all of this. And the things that you're experiencing are very interdependent. And so I've just tried to explain that to them and then also to give them a theory of why is this going on? And I talked about that a little bit in terms of resources, and then ultimately suggest some things that we can do about it. So that's the elevator pitch for the book. That's why people could buy it. If your listeners are listening, it does. I don't get rich. I don't even get middle class from you buying my book. If you know anything about the book publishing industry, but the reason I wrote it is I want these ideas out here. To get this type of book published by a mainstream publisher, which I did, it takes some doing. And I've been really fortunate that my publishers really stood behind the book and me. But the best way that they know that they should look for more books like this and that people are interested in these ideas is if you go to Amazon or Barnes and Noble or wherever you get your book, or go to your local bookstore and say, I'd like you to carry it. And, you know, you buy the book. And so again, it's not going to make a big financial difference in my bottom line, but it makes a huge difference in terms of the types of ideas that are allowed to circulate in 2024 in America.
Active participation is really important. I mean, this is true everywhere. The more that you patronize local businesses, the better they do, the more resilient your community is from external forces, including the government, right? The more you walk around and have your blood flowing through your body, the better health you're going to have, generally speaking. Just think of it like a river versus a pond, which one has more sediment and buildup in it. And this is the case socially as well. Like, actively participate in the things that are important to you, that matters that you do that, right? Because infrastructure builds around that demand. That's how it works. That's why I enjoy having authors of interesting things on, because the legacy media will go out of its way to suppress this shit, as will social media, as will Amazon themselves, as a matter of fact. They've pulled some of my friends' books off before, and definitely the New York Times is a fucking joke, but obviously they are probably the worst culprit there.
I was just gonna say, I've been really fortunate that I've been able to use some alternative outlets to get there. I mean, Tucker Carlson had me on, that helped a lot. 50 million views, it was the biggest episode he did since Putin. So I think there's a huge hunger to have an honest conversation about these issues, and folks like you allowing me to come on your show and talk about it are just invaluable for having that conversation.
Yeah, well, look, we enjoy it. I like learning new stuff. I enjoyed your book. There's a lot of, as you said, it's It's a very good soup to nuts breakdown. Like, here's the problem. Here's some ways to deal with it. Here's a problem. And by not by industry, maybe, but I don't know. However, it's sorted. So it's very easy to read. It's a lot of good information there. So you guys go pick it up. It's The Unprotected Class, How Anti-White Racism is Tearing America Apart. It is available now, actually. It went out last. As a matter of fact, if you buy it soon, maybe you'll get on the first week, and that'll help your New York Times bestseller opportunities.
There you go.
Jeremy Carl, thank you for coming today. I appreciate the conversation.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate you having me on.
Yes, sir. And thank you all for listening. This has been Citizen.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.